Any election year puts one of the central tensions in American life on display. And in this case, it's not conservative versus liberal. Rather, it's individual versus collective. On one hand, people believe we as individuals should have the maximum freedom to find our way in the world. On the other hand, people believe we have to work together for the greater good of all. Colin Woodard writes of this in his new book, American Character, subtitled The History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. Colin Woodard is a journalist with years of experience around the planet, including stints with the Christian Science Monitor and the San Francisco Chronicle, among others. He is currently the national affairs writer at the Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram in the other Portland. His four earlier books include American Nations, explaining how hard it is to unite states settled by very different people. Colin, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, great pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
So does this book pick up where American Nations left off?
It does indeed. For those familiar with American Nations, yes. The previous book was talking about why do we have these profound geographic divisions? Why are our ideological divisions correspondent with the geographical ones? How has it shaped our history and what has been at stake? And the new book is looking at what has been the central thing we've been fighting about, and what is the solution to it that would allow the Republic, as it were, to move forward?
Well, you pick an appropriate place to start. We get the Mayflower on page one, but then we have Rush Limbaugh commenting on it by page three, and the Tea Party, the modern Tea Party, on page four. What's that about?
Well, the book is talking, in the new book, American Character, is talking about the central struggle, which I argue has been around competing definitions of what freedom should be and means, what the pursuit of freedom is. Is it primarily, like you said, in individual terms of maximizing the individual's autonomy, sovereignty, and freedom, or is it about cultivating a free community through sustaining and maintaining the social, civic, and physical infrastructure that allows human freedom to exist? Because in policy terms, those can have entirely contradictory and oppositional agendas. And so in the new book, one of the, you know, the almost everything in our history has been captured by this struggle, right down, which I found sort of symbolically striking and a good way to begin the book, with our most powerful classic origin myth about the Mayflower arrival, you know, the pilgrims showing up off Provincetown, Massachusetts, you know, all starving and, you know, setting up their Mayflower compact and then deploying themselves on the shores. Even the meaning of that narrative has been captured in the past half century in this struggle over, you know, the contesting views of freedom. With Rush Limbaugh has this annual ritual at Thanksgiving where he retells the Mayflower story, except he's retelling it as a parable about the evils of collectivism and communism and the virtues of the free market. And he's drawing on a tradition that extended back and started in when Stalin was running the Soviet Union a half century before, this slowly developing narrative as the original Mayflower colonists as communists who discovered through trial and error that the correct way forward was, you know, individual initiative and destroying those structures. And that's the interesting part to me was that the story, that these things are such powerful and divisive elements that you would actually have somebody constructing that story. As a matter of facts, the story is actually, you know, that the lessons of the Mayflower in those terms are much more of a middle message about the importance of balancing those two things. Because the facts were that the actual, Mayflower party was involved in a joint stock corporation. They were essentially contracted employees of a corporation sent to work as a group and build the corporation's assets, and then at the end they would receive shares of the, you know, hopefully profits, as it were. So everybody was working together as employees of this enterprise. The problem was that they were in very much dire straits. They'd come ill prepared. They didn't have the correct supplies. They'd had a rosy assessment of the climate. They arrived in the wrong place. They weren't even in a place they had permission to be. They were supposed to be down in the Hudson Valley, and they ended up in Cape Cod. There was starvation and an emergency and a crisis. And within that crisis, they did discover, not before Thanksgiving, by the way, but at a later year, they were discovering that having people have the individual initiative to be farming on their plots and to actually be able to keep the production they did on their plots, that those incentives actually boosted production overall. And so they did make that change. They were like, instead of you bringing in all the common storehouse, you can each keep that as an incentive to have everybody work harder. And that did indeed work, but they were putting it all together still towards a collaborative enterprise because they all couldn't survive without one another. So, you know, if you're in an incredibly difficult circumstance with a small group of people separated from any hope of help and a dire circumstance, you want to stick together, but also tap on the initiative incentives of the individual at the same time. So it, in a way, it kind of wrapped all of those things together in telling, you know, the fable that was created and also showing what had actually happened in brief to set up the book.
So when we talk about this tension between individualism versus collective action, I mean, how hard is it for people to decide where they come down on this without first checking to see which other people and parties embrace which side or the other?
Well, you know, I think people do inherit values often and always have in politics, you know, based on, you know, the assumptions of their family or the party that they're voting for. But when people stopping and thinking it through is a really important thing because, you know, the American experiment, you know, simplified has been an experiment in trying to, you know, realize and hopefully maximize the possibility of people being free, of individuals being able to be free to, you know, do great things and pursue their dreams. But it's, you can't do that in just one direction. Is the music coming on? Do we need to shift for a break?
You have a little time left. About 30 seconds.
And so, very good. Well, yes, it's difficult for people to decide, but there are important things to understand about how you maximize freedom. You can't run off into the extreme of individualism or the common good and collectivism, because towards the extremes lie tyranny. The maximal point for human freedom and liberal democracy lies in a
Okay, Colin, we'll have to pick it up on the other side of a break. American Character is Colin Woodard's book. Back on the exchange with him and your phone calls and emails in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the journalist Colin Woodard. He wrote American Nations and blew us away a couple of years ago with a recognition of how different we are in the United States, that we are not terribly united often because the different parts of the country were settled by different kinds of people. He follows that up with American Character, a history of the epic struggle between individual liberty and the common good. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you say that extremes of individualism and extremes of collectivism, either way, we end up with tyranny, potentially. So it looks like, as you map out several periods in our history in the book, we've tended to oscillate from one end to the other, but generally sort of in the middle?
Generally, sort of. I mean, the extremes in world experience have been catastrophic tyrannies, and we've never ended up in that situation. We've persevered. You know, if you have the extremes of individualism where the government is, you know, less taxes, less regulation will bring more freedom, well, that's context dependent. That'll be true if you're a very oppressive place, but as you keep moving and shrinking the government and the taxes that allow you to reinvest in the shared infrastructure of society, you start eventually getting to the point where you're losing freedom, at least for the vast majority of people. And that's what's happened throughout history when you have very weak governments, or in the kingly period, very, very weak kings, you end up in a situation where private power, an aristocracy or an oligarchy forms, where a few families maximize their freedom and power and start taking it away from everybody else. And it's happened, you know, in contemporary El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras. You have a handful of families who basically rose in the context of a weak state to control everything, you know, the land and all business and the army and the courts. And, you know, if you are in government and if you cross them, you're in trouble. So there are two ways to go to tyranny. In the other direction, you go too far into collectivism. I think that's a little more obvious for people, where the individual becomes a threat to the collective, individual action and thought. You can have thought crimes, and you can't have any individual agency. You must surrender to the whoever is the keeper of the common good, be it the party or the fatherland, and pretty soon you're with Stalin's Soviet Union or Hitler's Germany. And so both of those are bad things, and logically that means that there's a balance point between the two, where those two essential aspects of freedom, individual liberty and freedom, which is sort of the ultimate goal of a liberal democracy, and the common good, the freedom of the community, the investment in the structures and the government, which is the agent which will ensure that the market and that society remain both free and fair, that the competition is fairly played, both that no monopolies end up forming an unfair competition, but also that intergenerationally on the social sphere, that people who are, you know, born to the have-nots, that there's still the leveling mechanisms and the civic and social and public infrastructure that acts as a leveling force to give those people a reasonable shot at being able to also fairly and freely be able to compete to their ability on the stage. That's a very American set of ideas that has had broad consensus in our history, but that need for the balance and achieving that sweet spot, and the fact that individual liberty, when you go too far, is imperiled by having less government after a certain point. That point seems to have been lost to the peril of the republic and the enterprise of trying to perfect a nearly universal, you know, society where nearly human universal, you know, freedom is possible.
Well, you know, you do bring in social biologist Edward O. Wilson here. What does he say about our wiring for all this? Is there some sort of default human thinking about individualism versus collectivism?
Well, the assumptions had been back when, you know, some of these ideas were first being entertained in England of the possibility of having a liberal state, and to have individuals in a republic. People like John Locke were imagining, well, how did everything start? And they were imagining these social contracts. They assumed that all of us started as autonomous individuals, you know, was the original human state of nature, and then we came together and created contracts with government to protect our individual property, and that's how things started. The natural state of humans is as solitary individuals. Well, you know, social biologists and now know that that's completely false. People who've studied the development of human societies know that it's in fact the opposite, that we evolved in tribes and groups as social creatures who, you know, only were able to succeed and were hardwired to exist within those social contexts. And indeed, most of our, you know, thousands of years of the history of civilization, individualism wasn't even, not only was it not on the agenda, it wasn't even a concept that existed. People lived in highly collectivized societies. In medieval Europe, you were thought each person, you know, the king or the priestly class to the peasant, was thought to be part of a giant harmonious social organism. I mean, so the natural state of things is actually collectivist. The possibility of mass individual freedom is a new thing. And E.O. Wilson's contribution, he was arguing that, in fact, right down to our evolutionary nature, to the way that we've evolved, actually has both of these components within it. He asked, how is it that some species created advanced social structures? And aside from us, the others that sort of qualify from biological terms are, you know, certain kinds of ants and termites and bees who live in hive-like societies with incredibly, you know, where individuals will sacrifice themselves for the good of the hive organism. Why are humans different? Where the other creatures who create these cities, you know, our cities are even more complex. And what he found was that we both have, in evolutionary terms, we have individual selection, like John Locke or Thomas Hobbes, you know, might argue, you know, the Enlightenment philosophers, that we're all in a competition with one another and may the best person win. That's going on, but simultaneously, we're also hardwired genetically to be social organisms. We're hardwired to join groups, tribes, to be fans of a particular baseball team, to rally around our particular nation and the rock band we like, whatever it is, and to consider our tribe or band to be immediately superior to the other ones. It's sort of hardwired into our nature. And we want our tribe or group to succeed over the other tribes and groups. So there's an individual selection going on in evolutionary terms and a group selection at the same time, and that we are the one species that's being pulled by those two gravitational pulls right down into our genetic nature, where our instincts are both can be greedy and selfish at the same time that we're pulled at doing things that are unselfish and altruistic, which are usually things we celebrate. You know, the person who dies for their country or jumps on the grenade for somebody else or selflessly risks their lives to help a stranger. Those are all things that people, you know, applaud. And at the same time, we also champion people, you know, competing and through, you know, their own, you know, success and merits, managing to create new things or become wealthy are also celebrated, particularly within America. But those are two elements of our nature. And it shows that, right down to our biology, we as a species are both individualistic and communitarian and associated with a common good. That's the actual truth of the human nature rather than the imaginations of Hobbes and, Locke that we were all, you know, autonomous individuals before government started. Quite the opposite. And it feeds right into the conflicts that we have, you know, in our own country trying to maintain, you know, a society with the maximum possibility for human freedom.
Colin Woodard's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is American Character, a history of the epic struggle between individual liberty and the common good, in which he documents how this tension has played out through our history and in parts of the country as well. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You write of the Founding Fathers being aware of the tension and setting up the government to accommodate it, I guess, is the best way we can say it. But then how much did the French Revolution, just a few years after the ratification of the Constitution, scare them into thinking that, oh, wait, maybe we got this wrong?
Yeah, well, the French Revolution was a seismic event. Initially, a lot of the, you know, founding fathers and people who had championed the patriot cause in the American Revolution looked to the French Revolution as being the next ally, the next people rising up to create another liberal democracy. Only that's not really what ended up happening. You know, the big fears of conservatives of that time period, you know, go back to the late 1700s, and, you know, the central figure philosophically in Anglo-American conservatism was Edmund Burke, and he was horrified by the French Revolution because, you know, classic, you know, conservatives at that time period were worried about conserving the social institutions and the legacy that exists and were extremely concerned about radical change. Change should come slowly because we've built up, you know, society and institutions slowly over time and you must respect them. The French Revolution, he warned, would end in chaos because you had people pursuing an abstract theory about human nature and we're going to sweep everything aside. All the institutions of society, the monarchy, off with their heads. We're going to rename the days of the week and the months and purge people. And indeed, so much of the institutional structures of France, be it a despotic place, but they pulled so much down that in came the terror, and the whole place was tearing itself apart, you know, with the guillotine and the loss of democracy. And what did it collapse into? You know, it wasn't a republic. It collapsed into Napoleon's, you know, empire and the conquest. And it's a sign that, you know, that having a liberal democracy and freedom is tied up also in the social institutions that surround it, but also in the citizenry. You know, people, it's not a natural state to have mass human freedom in a society. This is something that is a human achievement that was cultivated over, you know, really millennia of preparation and centuries of difficult experimentation. And it requires, as de Tocqueville and other people have noted, that you cultivate, you know, the habits of the heart in the citizenry to be able to be, you know, the key figures in a republic, where the citizens are the ones who are deciding ultimately who's going to run things and how things should be run. It puts a great burden on them being educated and civic-minded and wanting to pay back, you know, and support the civic environment and infrastructure that made their own opportunities possible. And if you have a citizenry that isn't prepared for those things, then democracy itself isn't necessarily going to guarantee human freedom. What if you have a society where if everyone was given a democratic vote, they would vote for a dictator to show up or have a dictator who would, you know, wipe out all people X they don't like immediately? I mean, that happens throughout history. You know, having a democratic vote is not tantamount to having a sustained free republic. And I think that's part of what happened that was so horrifying about the French Revolution is the French peasantry, you know, had a terrible experience in the poor in urban France under the monarchy, but they were not as a group a constituency prepared for Republican and civic values, and it descended into chaos. And that was the lesson that many took back here in America from the French Revolution as a sobering and fearful parable about the dangers of democracy. And that was the challenge the early republic was facing, is that, you know, Americans, many Americans, especially from certain regional cultures, wanted to democratize things. They didn't want an enlightened gentleman running the show and being there, you know, electing between enlightened gentlemen. They wanted they themselves, ordinary farmers and people, actually would aspire to public office themselves. And that was something that the French Revolution had scared many people in America, especially in the elite, so much that that itself became controversial and one of the tugs of war between the democratizing impulses of individual liberty and the more, in that time period, aristocratic notions about you needed to have sort of a House of Lords and people who would the common good, because in theory, because they were rich, they didn't need to get any more riches, therefore they would act in the interest of the people. That was the assumption in that time period, and the French Revolution sort of electrified and clarified those issues in the early republic and shaped a lot of the debate at the time.
So the tension really needs to be there, I think, is what you're saying. Nobody gets to win, and in fact, you make reference to our compromise-dependent institutions in this country. So nobody really should expect to be able to say yes all the time or to be able to say no all the time.
Well, yes, the architecture that the Founding Fathers created, they didn't create a parliamentary system. They created a set of checks and balances. They didn't, of course, envision political parties either. But the whole idea was that, okay, here we have a country which, as in American nations, I showed, is really a federation, an alliance of very different Americas, of very different, basically, nations with totally different values, and they're sharing a government. So, And the Founding Fathers knew this. They knew that the colonies had enormous differences between them on key issues. So the whole government was designed around the assumption of compromise, that each region would elect its representatives, and those representatives would come together and through these checks and balances would be compelled to come to a compromise solution, since they knew very well that, you know, by and large, they would not be in consensus agreement on very much. So the whole system is designed to require consensus and compromise, or you can't move forward because there are so many checks on runaway power. You know, the House and the Senate filibuster, and then the presidency and the Supreme Court to ensure you follow the Constitution and roles of state legislatures. It's all designed to require compromise. So if you end up in a political culture where people think that compromise is itself bad, that because we as a constituency in this part of one state have voted this person into office, that we want the entire rest of the country to be forced to take the same positions, and that anything else is treason to the people, that's misunderstanding the whole architecture of the government we created and is dooming completely paralyzed, because the system doesn't work without compromise by design.
Let's take a call here. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Colin Woodard, the author of American Character.
This is a brilliant book, Colin. You are spot on in your analysis, in my opinion. The observation I would make is that, yes, we've always been collectivist. You know, traditionally we've run around in clans of about 20 or so people. And the thing that makes those work are the same dynamics that make a larger society work. First of all, there has to be responsibility to the group in terms of the decisions that the individual takes. In addition to that, there has to be compassion, trust, and understanding that act as the lubricant among all of the social interactions that allow that social organism to exist. In terms of the oligarchs, and in terms of the polarization we're seeing today, frankly, the oligarchs are a cancer that have to be excised from the body politic if we're to survive as a species. And in terms of the gridlock, it's just like setting up for an earthquake geologically. All of a sudden, instead of moving along incrementally, a fault line locks, and the only way that will release is with an ever increasing release of energy and an increasing amount of violence. Those are my comments.
All right, thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it, Colin. You got about a minute to a break.
sure. You're talking in the first part, yes, about civic mindedness and civic virtue that early Republican thinkers and the founding fathers talked about as being a prerequisite for having a successful republic. You know, a lot of the burden is on the citizenry and on the citizenry having what de Tocqueville called those habits of the heart that, instinctively want you to contribute to the, the responsibilities of being a citizen and having this society, not solely the opportunity. So yes, you're correct there. I mean, I think that oligarchy, it's just a natural outgrowth when government becomes so weak, or, in medieval times, the king becomes so weak that it can no longer be a check on private power of the aristocrats or the plutocrats, whoever it is. That's where you end up. You head towards an oligarchy and that kind of tyranny. So it's almost axiomatic, and the rise of one is perhaps a symbol or an indication that you may have gone too far down the laissez-faire realm and that you're starting to imperil and reduce human freedom rather than grow it. So see that as sort of a warning sign, I think.
Wolfgang in Sunny Valley chimes in a similar way. He says, I like the theory, but has not the government lost its capacity to protect the people from the oligarchies by way of corporate personhood? We can explore that when we come back. We'll come back and talk more with Colin Woodard. He's the author of American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good, and more phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the journalist Colin Woodard, back with us with his latest book called American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good, about the ongoing tension at the core of our country, which is between individualism versus collectivism. Which one's going to do you the most good? People have very disparate feelings about that, but that tension seems to keep us going. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about oligarchy before the break, and again, Wolfgang in Sunny Valley asks specifically about corporate personhood, about whether that has a factor in making wealthy people more powerful in this country.
Oh, I mean, absolutely it does. The idea that, corporations are people for constitutional protections is is rather a novel idea, and gives them, since they are, unlike us, immortal, a sort of advantage on the landscape, on the constitutional landscape. But that is in itself an outgrowth of a long period of the movement being towards the laissez-faire individualistic side of things on that spectrum. The collapse of the greater New Deal order, you might say, that started with FDR and ran through the Eisenhower administration and Kennedy and Johnson, Nixon's first term before he, totally lost it. Nixon created OSHA and the Environmental Protection Agency and governed within that bipartisan consensus that was sort of in the middle stage. Well, since then, since 66 or 72, that's no longer been, the drift has been towards the laissez-faire side. And from Ronald Reagan's presidency in 1980 all the way through George W. Bush's administration, you had a pretty uninterrupted, where all of the motion was towards less government, less regulation, less social programs, more free motion for individuals and corporations. And that leads to things like having the Supreme Court, when you have a period of decades where that's the case, whether under Reagan or W or the neoliberal consensus under Clinton, you end up having, all kinds of things happen. In the long term, you have a Supreme Court's character and complexion change, where you have a majority of justices that will pass ideas about corporate personhood, which started, several decades ago, and have had their culmination with Citizens United. So, yeah, those are all, if you go back to the last time we had a laissez-faire excess, that was in the Gilded Age in the late 19th century, and again in the 1920s, and you had the same kind of, what to modern contemporary eyes are mind-boggling Supreme Court decisions about what is constitutional or not. The idea of that tantamount is the freedom of contract, that you can't have a minimum wage or a child labor law because that would deny the freedom of the child to work for any wage, that because a contract is entered into supposedly freely, that you would be denying the worker the right to be, you know, appropriately exploited, was basically the argument, which made it almost impossible to regulate any of those things. And that would seem strange to most people today, but that's an outgrowth of having appointments made over a long period of time during a period of, you know, excessively individualistic and libertarian administrations in the 19th century.
Here's another call from Candace in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Colin Woodard.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention something that has to do with your call, your program. In Christianity, before it was perverted, actually Jewish Christian beliefs, before it was perverted in this political thing we got going today, in true Christianity, the teachings are to treat your neighbor as yourself and also to be a servant towards others. It doesn't mean you don't get to be an individual, but it means to think about the other person that you may be affecting. And if people were actually following those rules, treat others as you want to be treated yourself, I think that covers everything, and people would be able to get along, because we are social animal creatures. That is taught in the Bible. We're social. And it just, the Bible is about getting along, because we do have selfish motivations many times. And so the Bible is about addressing the selfishness so we get along as social creatures.
Right,
but I wanted to see what you thought about that.
Yeah, thanks for that perspective, Candace. So Colin, when we talk about the teachings of Christianity, do you get into much of that in the book about the fact that this muscular Christianity that is used to defend a lot of capitalist principles?
Yes, some, and also in American Nations, because the spread of emphasis within Christian denominations on some of these issues is quite wide. Some denominations and traditions within Christianity emphasize the social gospel and the golden rule and the things that the caller was identifying. Others emphasize the need to follow the scriptures and the commandments, and that, you know, more of an Old Testament kind of emphasis, where, you know, God is vengeful and will, you know, punish those who cross the rules, and that the key is for the protection of everybody is that everyone follow the rules, and that there be no no compromise on that in a very vengeful kind of approach to things. There are some traditions that emphasize the here and now, that, you know, we can and should, you know, try to build a more perfect and godly society here. I mean, the Puritans were doing that in their own form. The Mormons do that today in that form. There are other traditions who say that the world is corrupted, that the emphasis has to be on the here and there. You know, that your relationship with the Creator and your standing with them in the afterlife is what matters. So those are all different denominations, and the key is that the mix of those traditions, that the proportions of them on the map, are very different from one regional culture to the other, which only feeds in to the cultural and political divides on a geographic basis between them. So that's kind of how I look at it, and where you have even Christianity itself has enormous variations in emphasis from one, you know, denomination and grouping to another.
Certainly. Let's take another call from Paul in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Colin Woodard.
Yes, I would suggest that if you take a look at the plot line and characters of Downton Abbey, you might get a good grasp of what our founding fathers had in mind for our nation, that class division was an acceptable form of vision. They saw that it is an organic family division, as long as the parental roles were served by benign dictators, monarchs that had the best interests of their all of the classes involved. The contrary model, of course, is the Iliad, where this rapacious group of adventurers come in to sack and pillage, and the heroes of that story are the Trojans, Priam and his people fighting off these sacking pillagers.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in this nation, we've been both. We've been benign dictators that were popularly accepted. The Theodore Roosevelts of the world, the rich people that benignly dictated the course of our history. But we've also been rapacious predators. And we always have a conflict between that.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. Wow. Colin, thoughts?
Well, the Downton Abbey example is a fun one because here you're looking at, you know, an aristocracy in Edwardian England going through those transformations, and you're seeing the very end in Downton Abbey of the landed aristocracy's traditional role in liberal England, liberal in the old sense of it. And remember, England, when John Locke and those other philosophers were articulating the first ideas of individualism, the context was that the nobles who were their patrons and who they were speaking for had just risen up and executed the king. King Charles had been beheaded, and suddenly the divine right of kings was no longer a credible explanation for how the political order should work. So in that context, they were trying to build a new theory about individuals and their relationship, the social contract theory and the ideas of the relationship between government and the people. And by the people, they meant those capable of civic virtue, meaning essentially the elite and their employers, the mass of people, the 70% of people out there, most of whom had been, were landless, recently made landless peasants who were considered a surplus population, need to be suppressed by just about everybody. They weren't even on the table. So you move forward to the Downton Abbey period, and England was in that era, in the Dickensian era, moving on to the Edwardian period, was largely liberal in that individual rights were respected in many, in property rights and constraints on the king's power, on the government's power. However, it was not a democracy. It was more of an autocracy because I can't remember in, the late 19th century, I think something like 8% of the English population was allowed to vote. You had to have property requirements to vote, that only wealthy people would have the civic virtue and the lack of, grasping survival interest to be thinking for the good of the community. That gives you the landed aristocracy as the guardians of the whole. They are the head of the household, and the lower people are the hands who will be directed by the head for the good of all, right? The aristocrats have an obligation to those under them, which you see in Downton Abbey, but they're also unquestionably in charge and should not be challenged because they are born into it and they have virtues that common people do not. That's not a democratic point of view. However, that's where the beginnings of the ideology of individualism started there in England around the time of the American Revolution. The difference was that when you came to America, you had places like the Chesapeake country around, Virginia and Maryland were exactly Downton Abbey. It was Downton Abbey only in its late, 17th century form, where you had, aristocrats who, begat families like the Madisons and Jefferson, and who were exactly in that same role. And they were supposed to be, deferred to because they were the most civic-minded, and you would, of course, vote for them into office. It never occurred to them that common people might not only, it was revolutionary to them that you would trust common people with the vote, as long as they had some landed property, but the idea that common people would start standing for office, butchers and farmers, was completely shocking to them, and that was something that came out of the democratization of the country, which was sort of an American phenomenon largely piloted out of the back country of these colonies, out of the greater Appalachian settlement culture, which valued individual liberty and individual freedom and respect and sovereignty. Those back country people been looked down upon by the Downton Abbey-like aristocrats in the lowlands of Virginia and South Carolina, had been denied political representation based on the proportion of their population in the colonial legislatures. And after the Revolution, it was those people who pushed and demanded and forced actual democracy onto the table. That's what the whole Jacksonian period is about. It's about the disruption of the Downton Abbey model because ordinary people felt that they themselves not only should have a stake in the civic process, but should also be standing for the legislature and the Senate. And that was something the founding fathers, by and large, not only didn't see, but found absolutely horrifying. They felt that their vision for the Republic had been disrupted. If you go back and read, a lot of what they said about the rise of the Jacksonian spirit towards the end of their lifetime. So, yes, but that's not where the American tradition went, and is what distinguishes us from the aristocracy of England in the early 20th century.
So Andrew Jackson, of course, from Tennessee, so from the South himself. And then one of the chapters of the book.
Greater Appalachian all the way.
Mm-hmm, yeah, when you lay out the periods of history here, Dixie takes over 1968 to 2008 is one of the final chapters here. So the Southern view of things, which is more of a rugged individualism, has really been at the forefront of this last 40 years then, 45 years.
Well, it's libertarian, but the different, you know, I say that there is no the South, really. There's really this greater Appalachian zone, which stretches into, you know, Ohio and southern Ohio, southern Indiana, southern Illinois, a large part of Missouri, the Ozarks, and into the Texas Hill Country, as well as the Appalachian Mountain chain and its core original settlement zone in south central Pennsylvania. That's the rugged individualism, democratic, egalitarian, don't look down on us. We don't. Orderly, efficient government has been self a danger. And that's different than what we just described with the Downton Abbey, Tidewater, enlightened gentlemen of the Chesapeake zone, mm-hmm. which is another part of the South, who are more of the mm-hmm. slaveholders, and distinguished again from the Deep South, where you actually had an oligarchy who came from Barbados in the West Indies in the 1600s, founded Charleston and spread over the Deep South, who had a much more rapacious version of things where Downton Abbey, where the Lord had absolutely no obligations to anyone else. And so you had three different Souths, but all of them were united by an ethic of suspicion of government and those common good principles, but for entirely different reasons, and reasons that often put Appalachia against the aristocratic cultures of the Tidewater and the Deep South. In fact, during the Civil War, Greater Appalachia was actually on the Union side.
All right, people don't have to go back and read American Nations to understand American character. In fact, there's a whole chapter that pretty much encapsulates the earlier book in this one. American Character is a History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. Another real barn burner from Colin Woodard. Colin, thanks for joining us again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, take care.